Marhaba, and welcome to the Matrix Green Pill, where real people connect.
Hello and welcome back to the Matrix Green Pill podcast. I'm Hilmarie Hutchison, and today I have Brett Gervin as my guest on the show. Brett is the principal of the Arbor School, an ecological school with a focus on sustainability. This is an absolutely brilliant concept, and I cannot wait to hear about it. Brett, welcome, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Lovely to be here, and thank you for having me on.
So as a start, can you please give us a little background information about yourself and how you ended up here in the UAE?
Certainly. I am a proud Kiwi, a New Zealander. I grew up on the beaches, the forests, the mountains, swimming in the ocean, making the most of all of the beautiful aspects of nature that we took for granted as children growing up there on the coastline. And I went to university eventually after my school days and studied zoology. And then I went and did a postgraduate diploma in environmental science. And from that, found myself going into teaching, where I was teaching sort of in the sciences. Still being a young man and making all the bad decisions that I probably shouldn't have made, but enjoying my sports and enjoying the wide world. And then eventually, after getting married, I decided to travel and we ended up in the UK. And we worked in the UK for a couple of years. I guess Kiwis tend to travel. And when we travel, we stay places for a while because it's such a long way to get anywhere from New Zealand. So we really got the travel bug. Anyway, long story short, eventually ended up going back to New Zealand to have our first child. Still had really itchy feet. And so it wasn't a long time before we decided to up and go again. So at that 2-year mark, we decided to head back overseas. And that's how I ended up in the UAE. So I landed in Al Ain, of all places, in summer, in Ramadan, about a dozen or so years ago. And that was sort of the commencement of my educational journey here in the UAE. So started as a teacher, went through some sort of leadership posts and subject and department and pastoral roles. And when I landed in the UAE, eventually moved my way through to becoming the principal.
Oh, wow. What an interesting backstory you have. You've traveled all over the place. So you mentioned having studied zoology. How did that lead you to becoming an educator?
It's only now upon reflection, really, that I see the links between what I studied and ending up in education, and certainly ending up where I am now at the Arbor School. But as a young man surfing and swimming in the ocean, I remember paddling kayaks beside orca whales, and I remember seeing the seas boiling with fish, and I remember paddling my surfboard over stingrays and dolphins. And those formative sort of experiences led me into zoology and what had originally planned to be marine biology. I saw the connection between humans' influence on the environment and how difficult it was to separate the two. And that's when I went into environmental science, which is sort of an ecological focus, but how humans can help to manage, preserve, conserve nature. And I loved it. I really enjoyed that sort of that connected understanding of science and human application. Out of that, I guess, whilst I finished studying and I was looking to not have to get back into full-time work, so I kept studying. And for me, the obvious next choice was to move into teaching. So I studied teaching and then I became a teacher and went into biology. That time in New Zealand, there wasn't an environmental studies course. And I guess my last year in New Zealand, I just started teaching an environmental studies course beyond normal biology.
We want to come back to this, but just for a moment, I want to just change gears for a bit and move away and just talk a bit about you and being an Ironman competitor. Let's talk about that just for a minute. So how did you get involved with being or doing the Ironman?
I love a personal challenge. I do. Fitness and being healthy is part of my life. I think you have to build it in. It can't be a sort of an additional or an add-on. It has to be built into your life. And so I choose challenges that I enjoy to do. I've been meaning to do a triathlon of length. And eventually I chose the Ironman, and my wife and I agreed that it would take some time for me to commit to it this year. So I decided to do the half Ironman, not a full Ironman, which is 70.3 miles or 2 kilometer swim, 90 kilometer cycle and 21 kilometer run. So that was just at the start of March, and I finished it, and I'm proud of it, and now I'm going to give it a rest.
Congratulations. Well done for starting and finishing it and going all the way through. Excellent. Let's get back to the Arbor School. So it's certainly based on some fantastic concepts. Can you please tell us a little bit about the Arbor School and about the programs that you have?
So it's an ecological school grounded in the national curriculum, the British curriculum. And so when the founders, the CEO, decided to build the school, they had a concept that stemmed not just from sort of a market niche. They didn't look at the market here in Dubai and say, oh, there's no one filling this gap, let's do that. It actually started with what's known as an ecosophy, which is a deep green philosophy. And that Ika Sophie says things like, we don't reach happiness through consumerism, we reach it through frugality. Nature is a sanctuary. We're not conquerors, we are collaborators, and on. So this deep green philosophy then led to saying, okay, what does that look like as a school? If we want to inculcate that idea in children, what does that look like as a school? What spaces do we need? What style of teaching do we need? What content would we need to teach? What skills and dispositions would we need our children to have? That philosophy really deeply underpins it. It's not a market decision. And then once we started to think about how that manifests, that's why the school looks like it does, and that's why our style of teaching is like it is. So we still teach reading, we still teach numeracy, we still teach literacy, we still teach science. Those are all fundamental elements. But what we're trying to teach is that in our journey towards sustainability, we take an approach called eco-literacy. And eco-literacy is, we're delving too deep right now, it's understanding fundamental ecological concepts and applying them to create sustainable human communities. It basically, it says, okay, recycling is good, cleaning up beaches is good, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with those things, but they're not going to get us to where we need to be as a world if we want this world to be a better place to live in. And that takes deep, long-term transformational change. And that deep, long-term transformational change needs to be carefully planned, it needs to be progressive, it needs to be thoughtful. And so as a school, we build it into what we do. So we build sustainability into where we teach, into how we teach, into what we teach, and being mindful all the time that we're not teaching our children about disasters. I don't need my four-year-olds thinking about biodiversity loss in the Amazon. I don't need my six-year-olds worrying about global climate disasters. I don't need my 10-year-olds worrying about fossil fuels. What I need them to understand is their connection with nature. And once they're connected with nature, they care for nature. And once they care and they connect, how can they be curious and ask the right questions so that when they get to an age where they can actually understand and have a purpose, then they're ready for those challenges. So we've got to really plan it carefully and the experiences that go along with it.
Absolute fantastic concept. And as you say, to start with the children now, because they are the future leaders. They are the ones who's going to make the changes in the long run. And I can see how, given your background, all these philosophies and this approach would certainly have resonated with you and your own beliefs and philosophies.
Absolutely. It was a strange twist of fate, because having had that background and always having been sort of slightly green, but not really deep green, you know, from my university days, I paid subscription to Greenpeace, you know, I studied ecology, and I have always been concerned the environment. But it wasn't until this opportunity arose here in Dubai, which is the strangest place for this kind of thing to arise, an ecological school in Dubai, to really bring to life the concepts that I'd sort of been on the slow burner for so long with me. It's a surprise, but it's what an amazing sort of fortuitous event.
A happy surprise indeed. You were saying you have all the fundamental regular classes. So do you have additional classes, or do you take some of the subjects and sort of swing them around to incorporate these philosophies?
A bit of both. We teach eco-literacy in the senior school. So if we think of it in terms of four words, we say it's curiosity, connection, passion, and purpose. And we sort of try and scale that through the school. So in the younger years, we're talking about curiosity, getting out into nature, connecting with nature, playing outside in the mud, asking big questions. Those are things that 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds can deal with. Then we look at connections. So we think about how we could teach that specifically. So we teach specific lessons about ecology, biogeography, different ecological ideas, different biospheres. And then as we get older and older, we start to build that into eco-literacy ideas. So asking big questions. How do you break down a big question? How do you design an inquiry that allows you to unpick these big questions and these big challenges before we go on into solving them? It's very much not just green. You know, it's not just switching off lights and looking at biological disasters. Because those, you know, again, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with those, but those are post hoc. The thing's already done and you're trying to solve it. What we need to do is get to the root cause of these challenges. We need people that think beyond just what do I do to solve the problems that are here right now. We've got to get beyond that. Yes, we teach it explicitly, but we also teach it implicitly, and it affects how we teach and where we teach.
How big is the school?
Numbers-wise, it's, you know, for the start of next year, it'll be around about 1,000 children. Most of that for us is in the primary school, so up to year 6. And we've got a growing secondary school. Next year, we're opening our year 10, which, if you're aware of the British curriculum, is the year they start their GCSE curriculum.
You're catering to the whole gambit, the whole from the beginning, they can go all the way through their curriculum with the Arbor School.
Correct. And I think it's necessary too. So it's just what we'd call a through school. So eventually we'll go from 3 years to 18 years. So foundation stage to year 13 in the national curriculum. And it's important because that journey, you know, I wouldn't want it to sort of stop start. We want to transform these children. So we want them to be different when they leave compared to when they come in. And again, it's not that they won't be different because they're more literate, numerate citizens, but they're going to be different in the way that they think, how they approach problems, what sort of green lens they apply to these challenges by the time they leave Arbor School.
Being the principal of the school and having been a teacher yourself, you've obviously seen both sides of being a teacher. What would you say is the formula to being a successful teacher?
I don't even know if there's a formula, because if it were a science, then everyone would get it right. Right. So pedagogy, which we talk about in education, is the science and art of being a teacher, of teaching. So the science is, I guess, if you're asking me what makes a great teacher, would be knowing the science and knowing what works and knowing how to apply it, knowing how to pull the right strings so that all of the 20 children in front of you are always challenged, knowing who to support and who to push, knowing what comes next in the progressive steps of learning, you know, knowing if I'm teaching fractions now or maths, what's the next more challenging circumstance. So the science of it is knowing exactly the tools that you have and how to apply them. The art of it then becomes being a master of applying those things. So when you've got those 20 children, and some of them are fantastically gifted and some of them are just learning still, some of them are emotionally challenged and some of them are ready to go, it's really being the puppet master to apply all of those knowns across the 20 children in a way that shows that you care and that you have a level of mastery as a professional that pushes them all forward, you know, not equally, but pushes them all forward consistently.
It must be a tough job. I don't envy school teachers, because I do think they have challenge. And as you say, because you're not dealing with 20 copies of children, they're all individuals, they're all different, they each come with their own set of skills that needs to be understood and catered for.
Yes. Some people use analogy. They say, oh, it's like having being a concert conductor at the front, making all the different pieces come together. But that would be fair if the orchestra had 20 people that some of them, you know, were upset because they'd broken up with their boyfriend, and some of them were emotionally not ready to play, and some of them just weren't able to play, and some of them were fantastically skilled practitioners. And if you could do that as a concert conductor, that would be fine. But in the classroom, you've got 20 completely different circumstances and their parents. And so you end up with quite a big clientele just in that one classroom.
Talk about the challenges that educators face. What are the biggest challenges? And do you think that the challenges in the Middle East are different from what educators face in other areas of the world?
Challenges, I think, for teachers anywhere is just being time poor. There's always something new in teaching, whether it's a new technique or a new piece of content or a new child joining the class. Something is always changing. There's very few days that always look like you planned them out to be. So being time poor and trying to make the most of your time without burning out, I think, is probably the biggest challenge. And as leaders, and I certainly haven't got it right yet, it's trying to maximize the use of your teacher's time so they can manage the well-being of their children, they can manage the well-being of themselves, and they can maximize the learning. So I'd say time is the biggest challenge for teachers. Is it different here compared to elsewhere? I would say, again, probably yes and no. The pressures of Dubai, I think, stem a lot from the fact that it is almost entirely a private education model. And so when everyone's paying, they have a different expectation of teachers they may not have in a public education model. And of course, most parents wholeheartedly engaged in their children's education and they want the best for them. And so that then comes with additional pressures for teachers. So that bit's tough. In a private education model that is generally a profit-making business, I don't think it necessarily reflects on teachers, but it might reflect on the school as a whole. And so that probably produces an additional level of challenge for teachers as well.
That makes absolute sense. Bringing it a little bit more personal, a bit closer to you, what is the one thing that you wish you knew when you started out in your career?
The one thing I could go back and tell myself would be to slow down. I've always been aspirational or ambitious, and that I was always looking for the next step. And I think I know now, looking back, that some things don't come with immediacy. Whether it's mastering your own craft or making a change in a school or bringing in a new element of the curriculum, taking time to really do them properly and to really master your craft is what leads you on to the next step. And I think that's something I really try and reflect on. And I'm trying to tell myself more as a leader to take time, which is not always easy. And I think for other young teachers that are working with me, quite often come into my office and say, you know, I'm looking for the next step. What's in my career pathway? I always say the first thing you should be right now is awesome. Be awesome at whatever you're doing right now. And either then I will see that and the next step will be here, or I will be happy to recommend you for the next step of your journey. So whatever you do, just be awesome at what you're doing right now. Take time to be a master of it. And then the next step will come. So I guess if I could look back, I'd say slow down.
I think that's excellent advice for anybody in any career, right? To be excellent at what we're doing now, and then the growth will come in time. Here's a question sort of for you personally and for you in relation to the Arbor School. Is what is one of your proudest moments in your journey until now?
You know, the Arbor School is many things. And when I say ecological, people sort of think green. So they think plants and animals. Those things exist, but it's far more than that, because it's ecological in the widest sense of ecology, meaning it's fully inclusive. inclusive. It means that you and I are connected as much as myself and the environment are connected. So that's just the preface why the next step was important to me. And so because it's inclusive, it's connected, then inclusion. So most people say that students are determination. Students with educational needs are a critical part of our school. One day I went down to one of our biodomes. We have 6 temperature controlled biodomes, 3 which are really large. And in the biodomes, we are having what was called Discovery Tuesday. And every child that had an additional need, whether it be English as additional language, whether it be high-level autism, any of those sort of range of challenges on the spectrum, were all in the domes at the same time. And they were having an absolute blast. And because we were meeting essentially every single need, there was not a behavior problem, there was not a connection problem, there was not a work problem, there was children splashing in mud, there was children working together, there were children helping each other. I can honestly say it was quite emotional for me when I walked in there. It was maybe, I don't know, let's say 40 children. Every single one of them was engaged in what they were doing and they were having an absolute blast. I mean, I didn't test it, but I could guarantee they were learning whatever it was that they were working on. And that for me was one of the proudest moments that I could have in that school. And it just showed, A, is how engaging nature is when used properly. B, the careful planning that goes into those activities produces great learning. And C, just what we're doing and its importance in terms of a transformational experience for the children. That's one of my proudest moments, Discovery Tuesday.
Now, you have mentioned a few times that you focus on the what, but also the where. I get the sense you don't, because you've just mentioned the biodome. So give us some other examples of how your where is sometimes different to what traditional schools might be doing.
Well, most of the time when we start planning lessons, you know, think, okay, the outcome is I want children to measure big versus small if they're really young. And so then you think, okay, if I want them to learn big versus small, I'm going to show them some big things versus some small things and get them to compare. Most of the time you'd start with doing that in the classroom and then maybe you'd group them. But actually, if you flip that around and started with where as opposed to what, where then becomes a really powerful tool. So for us, if I took that where to the biodome, then I can start thinking what and how. If I'm going to compare big versus small, I could do it with leaves, I could do it with animals, I could do it with sticks, I could do it with twigs. The difference between doing that in the biodome versus the classroom is that we get an immediacy of engagement. You stimulate more than just the size, you stimulate a whole series of questions and levels of curiosity. Thinking carefully about the where becomes really important. Now, it might be that you think carefully about the where, and the best place to do what you're talking about is in the classroom sitting in rows, and I'm fine with that. If there's an opportunity for you to take what your question is and take it somewhere else other than your classroom, then that's an important opportunity. For us, we have the biodomes, we have our biopark. We have our growing garden, we have our learning garden, we have reflection garden, and then we have the range of other facilities, auditoriums, your black boxes, your kitchens, and all of those become, you know, learning experiences going to the kitchen to cook, beyond going to the black box to do drama. They're places that you could take other elements of your curriculum to do well.
So interesting. And as you say, the learning from it then becomes so much deeper because it's not just one thing, it's taking it from so many angles. What advice would you give to a young person thinking about becoming an educator one day?
I would say that it's a challenge. I would say, you know, first up, one is it's a challenge. It's hard. Don't go into it thinking, great, we get holidays in the early afternoons. That's not how this game works. The holidays are there, but you need them. Secondly would be take time, because mastery of craft takes a long time. And thirdly, I would say plan carefully, because, and I don't mean that in terms of your life, I mean in terms of when you're taking control of a classroom full of children, every second of planning that you do prior to walking into the classroom is going to pay dividends. And the more work you can do outside the classroom, the easier it will be in the classroom. And I think probably fourthly, and I do this when I recruit as well, enjoy it. It's too hard a job to not enjoy it. If you find yourself really not enjoying it, then you've got to think about why you're doing it. You have to be able to have a laugh with the kids. You have to enjoy children. You have to be able to have a laugh with your colleagues. You have to be able to look at yourself and make a fool of yourself some days if that's how it's going to work. We're not clowns to entertain, but you have to enjoy the game. And if you don't, think about what you're doing.
You can get a lot of satisfaction.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a fulfillment from seeing children grow, but also fulfillment from a job well done. Like, cracking teachers are very hard to come across, and it takes a lot of work from them to be a cracking teacher. They're precious. I hope my teachers know that I care for them, and I hope they feel that valued in my school. But I know across the world, it's a challenge.
I think you're so right. If I think back to my childhood at my schooling, there's only a handful, a couple even, teachers who stand out that I can actually remember their names and who they were. For the most part, most of them just, you're almost happy to not see them again.
As long as you've got a couple of teachers, and the next child might have a different couple of teachers, and it goes through the school. So I think every teacher makes a difference to someone, and you might not ever know it. But as I say, great teachers are precious. And leaders in schools everywhere recruit really hard to try and find the best teacher they can, or help them to train to become better. And teachers, leaders in schools, it's an endless job of learning as professionals. We train almost as much as we expect the children to train. So it's endless. It's a challenging, rewarding, fun job, but it's hard work.
What is next for the Arbor School? Do you have any exciting plans or some near future you can tell us about?
I can't wait to get all the way through to graduating our children. So at the moment, we're up to year 10 for next year. So 10, 11, 12, 13. So in 4 years' time, we'll graduate our first students from the Arbor School. And that's an exciting sort of yardstick for us to hit. But next year, we're opening our GCSE group. So we're rebuilding and building the curriculum. We're also opening up the remainder of the second story, which has been something we've been focused on for the last 4 or 5 years. So that's exciting, fitting out the secondary school to take all the challenges and the needs and the wants of our big kids as they join, just continuing to cement what we do, because what we do, you know, I wouldn't say cutting edge, because most of what you would see in our school is similar to what you see in other schools, but it's at the forefront of the style of education that we want. And so there's no roadmap. We're not out there looking at other schools and saying, well, how do you do this? A lot of the stuff we're sort of trying on this set of clothes and seeing if it works, then we're trying on the next set of clothes and seeing if it fits better in terms of styles of teaching and ways of teaching. At the same time, trying to make sure we're not just experimenting on the children. That's not what this is about. Next year, we're starting with our GCSE cohort. We're finishing off the last of our building to be built and really just embedding all the good stuff that we've been doing thus far, I think.
Sounds like there's some exciting days ahead. Some challenges, no doubt, but something really to look forward to. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for telling us about the school, about your past, about you. I've certainly enjoyed that. But now we've come to the segment of our show where I will ask you a few rapid-fire questions. So when are you most productive?
Mornings.
Okay, and what is the first thing you notice about someone when you first meet them?
Are they smiling?
What is your favorite childhood memory?
Surfing at the beach, no doubt.
Sunrise or sunset?
Sunrise.
Oh yes, surfer, of course. What is one thing you do every day, no matter how busy you are?
Drink a coffee.
Well, that was easy. That was our game show. So before we wrap up, we'd like to do our Green Pill moment. For you, what was your Green Pill moment, the action or the event that was the turning point for you or your career?
Although it sounds like an advertisement now, as I honestly think my most recent job, i.e. the Arbor School, has been transformative for me. So what's always been a slow burner in my background, I stopped eating meats as a sustainability issue. I've gone vegan. As I say, I joined Greenpeace as a young man. I've stopped that since. It's just always been a slow burner. But since starting this job now, the idea of sustainability, actually more than sustainability, going up towards a regenerative, abundant world, has just come into the forefront of my mind for everything. It's all consuming in the way that I live and try to change and try to educate. It's definitely been transformative for me. So my Green Pill moment would be starting at the Arbor School as an educator.
So that certainly had a big impact on your life and continues to have a big impact. Well, thank you very much, Brett, for sharing this, your story. And it's certainly been an interesting ride and inspiring for me to think that there are schools like this that's taking these issues so seriously and teaching young ones all the way through their schooling. It's going to make an absolute difference in the future. There's no doubt about that. And I'm hoping some young future educators will be inspired by your story as well and want to take up, want to follow in your career path. So thank you very much for sharing that. Before we say goodbye, could you please tell our listeners where they can find and follow you and the school as well? And of course, we'll put this in the show notes as well.
Fantastic. Sure. The Arbor School itself is on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, all the usuals. And that's at the Arbor School. And myself, I am on Twitter is probably easiest, which is the Arbor Principal. And that's my handle.
Lovely. Thank you very much. Was there anything I should have asked or that you would like any last thoughts before we say goodbye? Bye.
I think my only plea for everyone is sustainability and a green school is not just about plants and animals. It's about making transformative changes to everything. And so that's what our school is about, is making a transformative change over a long period of time, not just the plants and animals aspect. They're great. They're a good part of our school. There's a deeper aspect to that. And if you take the green pill and go down the hole, it's hard to come back out of it.
Excellent last thoughts. Thank you very much. And thank you so much for being my guest today. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Appreciate it. It's been great fun.
If you enjoy our conversations, please like and subscribe. See you next Wednesday.